The Fearless Podcast, in a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act.
James Corbin, welcome back to the Fearless Podcast. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, thanks for coming back on. This just so happens to be episode 100, so I'm pretty pumped about that. I'm doing this kind of in my spare time, and it's kind of a passion of mine, so I enjoy it, and I finally hit that big 100, so it's an honor to have you on as the 100th episode guest.
Honored to be here, and, you know, most podcasts don't make it past episode 10, so, you know, 100 really means something.
Yeah, so the reason I wanted to have you back on is you recently published a new book. It's called Reportage, Essays on the New World Order. And I thought it was very well put together as far as a compilation, because I think the last time you were on, we kind of talked about like your red pill moment, and you talk about it in the book, you know, having free internet access and at this time in history when there were these streaming platforms just evolving and different things and kind of going down the 9/11 rabbit hole. What I find so fascinating in 2025 is that we can have all of these revelations, you know, and we can have these guys like Alex Jones, right, that they've peeled back the curtain, and they've been able to decry the New World Order and Bilderberg and all these different things and kind of have street cred for predicting, you know, like very recently Alex Jones was on Tucker Carlson, and Tucker Carlson kept reiterating, but how did you call Osama bin Laden and 9/11 right? Now, for any of us other rabbit holers that have already been down the rabbit hole, we all know that William Cooper predicted that prior to Alex Jones, and they actually had like an internet beef about all of that. But what I find fascinating is once you peel back the layers and connect the dots with these different rings of power or control, like whether it's CFR, whether it's Bilderberg, whether it's something broader like tragedy and hope. Once you connect these dots, like, I don't understand how people can get sucked back into this right-left paradigm, you know, and then the info brokers in this info war, they're allowed to like sidestep reality. And that's what I just thought. The order in which the book was compiled, the way that you put it together, you connect all these dots and this chain can't be broken. So once you're in this real space with real facts and all the associated facts that are hyperlinked here, it's very difficult to shove the genie back in the bottle. And that's why I really appreciated the book.
It's difficult for me to comprehend how people who have seen past the veil can possibly go back to living that former life of blissful ignorance, at least ignorance. Although, as you say, it's funny to me that, for example, the guy who made the documentary films on martial law has in recent years called for martial law because it's the good guy doing it. We can trust Trump. The same guy who, a decade plus ago, during the Obama birth certificate shenanigans, he was calling Trump out for being, oh, this is all political theater. He's not, you know, he's just in it for self-promotion. But now he's all on board the Trump train. The same man who was warning about the North American Union a couple of decades ago is now calling for, hey, well, we need to take over Canada and Greenland. I mean, it's bizarre to see, isn't it? And I don't know what, I can't see into the hearts and minds of men, so I don't know what's going on underneath it. It seems to me that once you see through this, it's pretty hard to not see it and to get suckered back in. Maybe it can happen. Maybe it can legitimately happen. Maybe there are other forces that can make people say things that they don't really believe. But at any rate, I would like to say that my track record shows a bit of consistency on these subjects. And uh, I'm not, I'm not bowing at the feet of any politician. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and that's why I would always direct people to your work, because you had a consistent track record that was unchanging according to any type of right or left paradigm. Now, partially that's because you are a Canadian living in Japan, so that kind of gives you this extra layer of unbiased perspective where you don't have a dog in the fight. And then for the rest of us that have a vested interest in, well, I think all as humans, I think we all have a vested interest in our continuation and propagation and moving into the future, which is great that you included in your book. It was a letter to the future. I thought that was very succinct, very well written. And I mean, that's the purpose, I think, why we all do what we do, is we are all concerned for our posterity. We're concerned for our children and our children's children. My oldest son's got married last year. They just found out that they're expecting, you know.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. So, I mean, this is the reason why we stay up to speed and up to date. Another thing that I'm incredibly fascinated about is how all these politicians, I mean, they're incredibly wise businessmen and they're ahead of all the curves and these different things, but, oh, they were just in the dark about that one thing. You know, they got duped on that COVID thing, or they just don't see Palantir and all of these new, you know, Lucky Palmer and the PayPal Mafia and, you know, all of these track and trace, drag and drop, you know, CIA, deep state, AI, panopticon type, like this cyber cage that they're trying to round us all up into. You know, this is great because of, you know, the good guys and, you know, and this is why all these guys support Trump and Trump pays them and Trump funds all this stuff. But then when it literally enslaves us, well, he just, you know, he was just misguided in that when it came to cybersecurity or whatever. It's like, but here I am. I'm some like Joey Bag of Donuts. I live in the middle of nowhere. I got 6 kids. I have a pretty successful, you know, business. I provide well for our family, and somehow I can stay up to speed on all of this. And I know what's going on, but like the most powerful guy in the Western world, well, he just got hoodwinked on that one.
Yeah. You know what? To some extent, that's the beauty, if you want to put it that way, I guess the real ugliness of the left-right paradigm in terms of if you want to control a population, what is the best way to do it? You create these two teams. And both teams are dirty, and both teams are playing the same game. And ultimately, at the end of the day, yeah, the two teams may be competing with each other on this particular field, but they're both owned by businessmen who, by the way, go to the same club after the game, you know? And that's the perspective that we need on this, but we don't have that perspective, generally speaking, and it's never put in front of our faces, so that when one team is in power, they can always point out the dirty laundry of the other team. Oh, look at what they were doing. And get cheers and applause from their crowd because of that. And then, of course, it changes, and the exact same thing happens in reverse. So when Obama was coming in, hope and change, let's get rid of these neocons, we're going to turn things around, and of course, really just extended the never-ending war on terror, the torture, the NSA spying, all of that continued on happily under Obama. But hey, it's our team, said the people on the left. And then when Trump gets into power, he can continue doing all of the things that that the government's going to do, all of the same nonsense, and even extend it in terms of, for example, the AI and Project Stargate. We're going to make America great again by creating an algocracy or whatever it is. And unfortunately, half the population has been trained like seals to just arf and applaud because it's our team that's doing it.
Yeah, and you know, the book covers topics like the war on terror and 9/11, but then it also gets into all of this genetic manipulation stuff, whether it's mRNA, whether it's GMO seeds, And we're watching these different things unfold with this new regime, you know, and RFK Jr., even though his family has been, like, deeply ensconced in the recesses of the Democratic Party, and his blood was blue and all this stuff, but magically he transversed the rainbow, and now he's like this arbiter of the Republic and all this stuff. And you know, meanwhile, now there's this new measles outbreak, and the MMR vaccine is actually good and it doesn't cause autism. So we constantly see this, like, this rubber band effect, and you know, and that is part of the psychological operation. And the most frustrating part for us normal people is you can never question the narrative, you know, because of this duopoly. You can never question the narrative, because if you question the narrative, then and in my opinion, that's what draws people to libertarianism. I mean, I believe that the Austrian economists have the economy right, and then the anarcho-capitalists have the government right, in the sense of voluntarism. And, you know, they're willing to talk objectively about what's going on and what's being done, and because they don't have a dog in the fight, they want to be objective. And, you know, so I do see progress in that sense of people becoming aware, but then they create these pitfalls and traps inside this right-left paradigm, like creating Trump as this, like, underdog. And what I like to point out in this Trump narrative is he has never once suffered any repercussions from all these attacks. I mean, you know, he was charged with all these crimes, never convicted. He was supposedly attacked financially, yet his net worth continues to climb. He was shot at and miraculously survived, you know, and now he's like, and that really crowned him like this political messiah. Obviously, God has chosen you for such a time as this. And, but, you know, now 3 or 4 months have went by. So, and we watch more and more of the same old. This is the thing that I was talking about with RFK Jr. Like, and a lot of people say, hey, just give him a year, you know, it's politics. Well, we're 4 months in, he's a quarter of the way done. And like, if there's no real virtue, or there's not a real cause here, then obviously it's going to continue to vacillate back and forth, and there's no consistency, there's no truth.
Yeah. You know, that resonates with me, because I have always thought, even back in the time when I was a statist who cared what politicians think, I always thought it was a stupid argument that people would make. Well, it's politics. They got to play the game. You can't say anything about whatever topic it is, 9/11 truth or anything else, because of course, you know, it's politics. They'd never get voted in again. But my point was always, well, yeah, I don't want, why would I want to put my time, my energy, my identity, my power behind someone who's going to not say the truth because, well, you know, that's not popular enough. I can't say that. No, I would want someone who would say the truth, even if it means that they wouldn't get what they wanted politically. And I just, it's never made sense to me why people would want to support people who are, even if you think, oh, Trump's really a good, RFK Jr. is really good underneath. It's just, he can't be, you know, perfect. Even if that's what you thought, why would you support someone who's going to hold back on what they think to be true? Yeah, I don't know. Doesn't make sense to my mind.
Yeah, and you know, this is the whole concept of representation, right? You're supposed to be voting for somebody that represents you, and maybe it is because we've become so flaccid and docile as a constituency, which is why this strongman is so attractive to all of us bread and circus sports ball people that have been, you know, with the video games and the sports ball and all this synthetic war, you know, to try to motivate us to remain docile. Maybe that's why it's so attractive. But another thing that very recently that I point to is this whole entire tariff argument, because I've been having different guests on. I had Matt Arid on, and then I had Payman Ascari. He's a Canadian politician running up there in Canada. And I asked both of them, I'm like, do you think that any political leader, especially in America, would expend the political capital to extract the liquidity from our monetary system? Because we can have all these fake arguments about tariffs, you know, and the tariff argument is like, hey, it's short-term pain, right? But it's going to create all of this equity and fairness in our economy globally. But if you extracting liquidity from the market is going to create an enormous amount of short-term pain, right? But it will bring a soundness back into our monetary system that just by that soundness returning to our monetary system, the free market that we do still have will be very buoyant and will flourish in that environment. But instead, we have to have this like fake argument. We have to allude that the personal income tax is going to be abolished. First, you have to allude to the fact that could never happen. It would never happen. It shouldn't exist to begin with. So why in the world would they take it away? Because it's not even constitutional, but it would never happen. And now we have to have this like fake argument about tariffs, right? And these tariffs aren't even predicated upon real tariffs, but they're formulated according to the percentage of trade deficits. So it's not even, you see really smart people and financial influencers and all of these smart talking heads. And you see people parroting all this stuff about the tariffs. And here I am once again, I am this hillbilly redneck, not really smart. Definitely have more street smarts than most, but I'm not like intelligent. And this is like a false argument we're having about tariffs, which is really just another form of passive tax. And, you know, Doge makes all of these cuts, right, and finds all this waste, yet we still need to raise the debt ceiling and have a continuing resolution, you know, and we need to fund the Department of Education before we dismantle it. Well, then what are we going to do with the money? Like, it's always like, what are we going to do with the money? That's what's so disturbing.
Right. And I think you get to the point when you start looking at the structural issue itself, because my question for Americans would be, what is the number one American export? And the real answer to that is not, obviously, I don't know, motorcycles, jeans, no. The number one American export is dollars. That is what people around the world are gobbling up in one form or another, whether that's treasuries or what have you. But at a certain point, what the trade deficit actually is the functioning of the world system that's based on the monetary paradigm of the dollar as the world reserve currency. And that is an incredible position, which basically is, in a sense, the capstone of the pyramid of the America, Pax Americana, world unipower system. And to dismantle that, well, sure, okay, you can, but you better understand what it is you're giving up when you start to dismantle that, which is the direction this is going. And really, how is the dollar, as it has been structured, what is that? Of course, it is debt that is created by the Federal Reserve out of thin air, essentially. Not really out of thin air, out of the promise of the people to pay back debt. That is how dollars are created in the system. For the most part, is through bank loans, which, of course, is just your promise to pay it back at some point in the future. But, and how is the dollar collateralized? Why do people trust the debt of the U.S. government is because, well, largely because of the income tax. And because, yeah, we'll shear the sheep as needed to get that back. That is how the system is actually structured. And unless you understand that, this whole thing about how should we best manage trade internationally and all of that is all parlor games, smoke and mirrors. Yeah, I think it does need to be dismantled, but you have to know what you are dismantling and why you are doing it. And does anyone think that Trump is dismantling this system so that he can then create the, you know, the sound money system that should exist? No, he's doing it so that he can control the Fed and he can control what they're going to do. And we've seen any number of indications of that from his first term and now into his second term. I don't think that that fundamentally is going to be, he's not trying to bring down the Fed. He's just trying to control the Fed. And I don't think that's the winning move in this game, because it's a game that's been created by the bankers for the bankers' benefit.
And this is the larger point that I make, you know, because now there's this, the new idea is to China's the new boogeyman, you know, and there's BRICS, and then there's Crink, right? And then this is because China bad, and, you know, that's why guys like in the military industrial complex, do you know that China can, the largest Chinese shipyard can create 250 times the amount of boats that the largest U.S. shipyard is, and we need to bring this equilibrium back of, you know, of military might and all these different things. But if you have our country that is not practicing any type of fiscal soundness, right, when it comes to monetary policy, and then you have a hybridized communist country that is not practicing any type of like, how do you compete in that realm where if they can control the value of the yuan and they can print it as fast as we can print a dollar bill, like, how it's a race to the bottom. Like, it's and that's the really strange thing. And that's why a book like Tragedy and Hope, Carol Quigley's book, that kind of connects all these dots as far as why China was selected, how they did it, basically why they transferred all of our production to China to create this new system that now that they have all the manufacturing, you know, now there's this, I don't know, fourth industrial revolution. You're always trying to guess what the spin is on the game, but it's definitely a great game that's being played by they, them, and those. And
absolutely, you know, and who is playing that game? Because we here at our level of the information pyramid, we get told it's all about the nation states and it's the US versus China and all of that sort of thing. But there is an entire different reality that you start to encounter when you start asking some questions. So for example, in my essay on how to play 3D chess, Escaping the Grand Chessboard is the name of the essay, but it does have a section on how to play 3D chess, in which I ask some questions about China and how it became this gigantic economic boogeyman behemoth of the late 20th into the early 21st century. How did that happen? Just spontaneously, they just sort of... No, there was obviously a concerted effort to offshore and to create the financial infrastructure for China to do what it has done. So in that essay, I ask some questions. For example, why did Yale News openly brag in 1972 that without Yale's support, Mao Zedong may have never risen from obscurity to command China? Why did David Rockefeller's political operative, Henry Kissinger, engage in a secret diplomatic trip to China in July 1971 to prepare the normalization of U.S.-China relations at the very same time that Chinese forces were aiding the Viet Cong in their battles against American forces in Vietnam? Why was this move praised by Grand Chessboard Masters Bingdu Brzezinski, who was supposedly Kissinger's rival from the other side of the left-right aisle of the foreign policy establishment? Why did Brzezinski continue to push forward this normalization of relations when he took over as President Jimmy Carter's national security advisor in 1977? Why did Rockefeller assemble senior executives of close to 300 major U.S. corporations in the penthouse of the Chase Manhattan Bank building in June 1980 for a meeting with Rong Yiren, chairman of the state-owned China International Trust Investment Corporation. Why did Rockefeller use that meeting to formalize an agreement between the Chinese government, the Bank of China, and Chase Manhattan Bank to identify and define those areas of the Chinese economy most susceptible to American technology and capital infusion? And why did Chase commit to recruit specific American firms to provide both the know-how and the money for that infusion? Why did DuPont, Ford, General Electric, General Motors, IBM, Intel, Lucent Technologies, Microsoft, Motorola, Rohm and Haas, and other Western technological and industrial powerhouses all open up research and development facilities in China in the 1980s and 1990s? Why did American companies actively break the law in the 1990s by assisting the Chinese government with its ballistic missile program? Why do so many of the high-tech, cutting-edge gadgets in the Chinese military arsenal, from the Shenyang J-31 fifth-generation stealth fighter to the Sunward SVU-200 Flying Tiger unmanned helo to the Dongfeng EQ-2050, known as the Chinese Humvee, just happen to closely resemble American military technology? And why does that Chinese technology hew to U.S. military specifications so strictly that it even displays information to its Chinese operators in English? An oddity that prompted even the staunchly anti-conspiratorial Popular Mechanics to ponder whether or not software and other technology originally from the United States and other Western countries is flying on Chinese military aircraft. I could actually go on with that. Anyway, there are references to every single thing that I'm asking and talking about there in the book, so I hope people will take a look at that. But yeah, once you start peeling back the layers, it's not like, oh, China just suddenly became this economic powerhouse. No, there was a concerted effort to put them in that position. And now, of course, they yield the exact same benefits that they did from the Cold War 1.0 in the 20th century. The Soviet boogeyman, who incidentally was also propped up in numerous different ways, and Anthony Sutton has done a lot of work on that, yep, specifically, the technology transfers to the Soviet Union. But once you start to see, oh, I get it, it's to have the boogeyman. In the exact same way as internally, domestically, you have the left-right system to keep people divided and keep the there's always some boogeyman you can be pointing at. It was them. On the grand stage, on the global stage, they need that as well. And it goes back to, I mean, I always cite it, I'll cite it again, Orwell's 1984. East Asia, Eurasia, whatever, one of them's our friend, one of them's their enemy, depends what week it is. Bombs are raining down. We don't know who's dropping the bombs. It could be our own government. We're told it's East Asia, whatever. Last week we were told it's Eurasia. It's just the system that is most susceptible, most amenable to essentially manipulate people into a social situation where they're going to go along with it. And obviously the 21st century version of that is China bad, boogeyman, we have to get China. And the funniest part to me watching all of that, the development of the China boogeyman narrative, is that you get little glimpses of it here and there where, for example, during the scamdemic, when they were locking, literally, hammering the plywood over people's doors so they couldn't escape as they were being nailed into their homes, you started to get these hand-wringy sort of editorials from the New York Times and other mouthpiece establishment media going, oh, it's, you know, look at these horrible things that the Chinese... But, you know, it's very effective. It's very effective. They don't have to deal with all these rights issues and the, you know, the Bill of Rights and all of that. They don't have to worry about that. Isn't that kind of good?
Yeah, they were literally welding people into their high rise, welding the steel door shuts to the door jamb. And then obviously, like, yeah, that's what communism is all about. But yeah, that, you know, their tracking and trace methods are very effective, you know, safe and effective. So, you know, that's what's fascinating, that laundry list from the 70s and 80s of this mishmash of China and technology and production. None of that was foisted on them by a blue-haired DEI transgender whatever. I mean, that's the new talking point, you know, like, right, oh yeah, these are people that hate humanity, you know, and all this stuff. But I mean, in a very real way, predominantly the so-called right did most of that, you know, and all these capitalists, you know, took their capitalism to this communist country, and they created this beautiful quasi-capitalist communist utopia, you know, where
right. You can, well, let's call things by the right name, because you're right. Yeah, so it's people that would be associated with the right. Although, you know, the Rockefeller family are kind of the blue Democrats or the red Democrat, whatever they call them. You know, like they're kind of halfway in between. But no. Clearly, people would associate these big businessmen and these billionaires with the right side of the equation. And we would say, yeah, they're exporting capitalism to this communist country. But those aren't quite the right terms. I mean, we have to understand the crony capitalism that exists, which is the state capitalism, which is different than the idea of a truly free market. Nobody on the political stage, on the grand political chessboard, is advocating for truly free markets. They're advocating, no, it should be managed in this way. And the Chinese have a different sort of concoction that they sell to their public, but it's still a form of crony capitalism at this point. It's all this mishmash of state and business that is being melded together, and more so on the Trump side, I would say, in recent months, as literally they're selling the Easter egg, whatever thing they do at the White House. They're literally selling advertising to companies and stuff. I mean, it's getting quite obvious that, yes, the government is a business and they're going to treat it as such. Having said that, that kind of is the point that, for example, Sutton was pointing out when he was asked, okay, so why would these capitalists have been helping the Soviet Union? Why would they have been supporting their enemy? And his response is, because ultimately this is about merging the concept of the capitalist world with the communist world to get what they would say is the best of both, what we, from our perspective, would be the worst of both, the kind of complete control over what you say, what you think, what you do, who you act with, who you interact with, whether you're allowed to leave your house. All of these things are the same things that people on both sides of these aisle, this imaginary divide, the capitalist-communist divide, they're all on board with that, because fundamentally what is guiding them is an ideology that they are fit to rule over the masses and that they are going to benefit from that for themselves and their progeny. And you will be tolerated to the extent that they need to tolerate to have the sort of the lower classes working the machinery of the system for as long as they're required to work the machinery of the system. But hey, we're getting all this automation coming into view, and it may suddenly, the old dream of getting rid of the useless eaters may be, you know, more realizable than ever.
Another beautiful illustration of this exact same thing when it comes to global politics and war and all these other different things is this guy, one of the Palantir guys, this Indian, his first name is like Sham Punktar or something like that. And he was just on the Sean Ryan show and they were like, wow, yeah, Palantir, great. This is so cool and awesome. But he was like, well, yeah, it's just like Operation Paperclip, you know? We wanted all the good German scientists, you know. Yeah, they were Nazis, and they did genetic experiments, and they exterminated people, and they were terrible. But we thought if we could get this technology and use it for good, you know. So we brought all these Nazis over here because we wanted the tech. And now check out the really cool tech we have. I mean, look, we're going to the moon, and soon we'll be going to Mars and all this cool stuff. But, you know, it was worth it. Now, I realized the talking points were we were fighting the Second World War to defeat Hitler. And Hitler is obviously a really bad guy, and he is the current embodiment of evil. But there is a large amount of information and data that does say that Hitler went to Argentina. And there's an even enormous more amount of data that says that we took all the bad guys that were doing all these horrific type things, and we brought them here so that we could get the tech because the ends justify the means.
Yeah, exactly right. Operation Paperclip, for people who don't know about that, they should look into it. There's a lot of information about the way that, yes, we will collaborate and use not only German Nazi scientists, but of course a lot of Japanese scientists that were involved in Unit 731 and other such horrible, unthinkable, disgusting human experimentation. Well, they got a lot of information out of that, so we better spare them and find out what they learned in their disgusting human experiments. And unfortunately, that was the prevailing mindset at the time. It isn't because there was the next boogeyman to worry about, the Soviet Union. So we've got to win that that arms race in every sense, and that justified anything. And one perfect example of that, of course, is NASA. From the top down was filled with Nazi scientists, right? And what's the main rocket guy?
Werner von Braun.
Yeah, Werner von Braun, of course. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and it was fascinating how he was telling this story about how they relocated him to Alabama in the middle of nowhere on purpose. And that's kind of how this whole thing started. And it's amazing the way that they can like repackage this stuff and make it sound so great. But historically, I mean, I'm a product of the Prussian school system. I mean, I went to government school so that I could learn how to be a good cog in the machine and a widget and, you know, not and raise my hand and, you know, and all that kind of cool stuff. And but once you learn something like that, you're like, well, wait a minute. The Houghton Mifflin textbook of world history taught me that we were, you know, it was the Axis and the Allies, and we were there to destroy Hitler and destroy Nazis and bring freedom to the world. And meanwhile, the reality was very stark and opposed to that. And now, once again, they're telling us these exact same things Palantir, you know, Palantir, we're going to use AI, you know, the bureaucracy. And he literally said this. Now, this sounds a little technocratic. And I'm like, no way, bro. So governments and humans are inefficient, you know. And the reason that we have terrorism and stuff is because we can't react quick enough. So if we can have an algorithm, and enough artificial intelligence, and don't worry, you know, people will only be able to look at the stuff that they're allowed to look at. So you'll still have privacy and everything, and you'll still be really private and all this cool stuff. But autonomously, this AI software is going to stop the bad guys, you know, quickly.
Yeah. It reminds me of what Larry Ellison was saying last year about how AI is going to make policing so much better because the cameras will be watching everyone everywhere at all times, even in the bathroom. And that will make people better people and will make policemen more honest, right? So, although it is an interesting phenomenon that every time there's any sort of spectacular event, all the cameras failed all at the same time. Wouldn't you imagine that?
Every time.
Like on 7/7, all those key cameras just went down on 7/7 for some reason, or on April 20th, 1995, right? The Alfred P. Murrah building where there were cameras that were absolutely pointed at and capturing McVeigh and John Doe number 2 pulling up to the building. People might know of the Jesse Trenadue, who has been a lawyer who's been fighting the FBI for decades now on trying to get that information out. And for example, he managed to get all of the CCTV footage that was tracking the Ryder van as it was coming towards the Alfred P. Murrah building. And wouldn't you know it, every single time, just as the van is passing, the camera goes out just in that particular section of the footage. And of course, the footage of the van parking and the two people getting out, it turns out, it has been seen. It was reported on at the time by local news. There have been people who saw it, but the FBI say, we can't find it. It must not exist. So there you go. What are you going to do?
Yeah, unbelievable. But I really like the way that the book. I know Whitney Webb wrote the preface to the book. Whitney Webb has been getting a lot of great exposure lately for her work with One Nation Under Blackmail. So she's a kind of an intrepid researcher. She's been doing this for a really long time, and so it was kind of neat that y'all teamed up, that she was willing to write the preface. I thought that was really cool.
I'm very grateful to her for doing that. Yeah, it's obviously I shouldn't need to say, but I'll say it anyway. Whitney does incredible work, incredible research. So it is it's good to have her imprimatur on this book.
And kind of like the last thing that's fascinating to me about, like we were talking about, like, you know, your red pill experience and the advent of the internet and this information that was out there, right? And then we've all experienced this whole process as the algorithm changes and the filter changes and the online censorship. But what's fascinating is that there is this exact same technology that is being manipulated to enslave us is the same technology that this information is still able to eke out through, even though it's obviously suppressed. I mean, I can imagine that this video will get 300 views on YouTube, which is why we push it out through all the different avenues that we have available to us. But the encouraging and beautiful part of all this is that with all the technocracy, with all the censorship, with all of the AI and the algorithms, the information is still getting out there. People are still at least interacting with it and entertaining it and thinking about it. And, you know, nobody wakes up all at once. You know, you'll get a piece of information here, you'll get a piece of information there, and you'll connect the dots, or maybe something will happen to you in your life where you have an interaction. I know a lot of people that have a very inert concept of the state, right? And then what will happen is that they will have an encounter with the state, and it'll be over some bureaucratic abnormality. Maybe it'll be an audit. Maybe it'll be something like that, or maybe it'll be a permit. It'll be something incredibly benign, and it makes their life incredibly difficult. And then they're like, hey, wait a minute. Maybe I had this whole idea backwards. Maybe government should be so small that we can barely recognize the fact that it exists. You know, maybe we can have roads and bridges without tolls and all these different things, you know?
I had an experience like that, actually, that was maybe, I don't know, I can't self-psychoanalyze, but maybe prepped me for doing the work that I do at the website. It predates the story that I tell in here as my origin story, falling down the internet rabbit hole, by about a year. About a year before that point, I was here in Japan. I was going back to Canada to visit my friend. It was his wedding. I was going to be the best man. So I fly into Vancouver on my way back to Calgary. And the first thing customs does, you know, they're asking the questions, you know, why are you here? And I make some offhand joke, oh, I'm here to watch the Flames win the Stanley Cup. Customs officers do not have a good sense of humor. So I just see he scribbles something on my paper, hands it back to me. Next thing I know, somebody's coming up, you know, you got to come over here for extra screening. And, oh, okay, all right, this will be fun. So get my bags, go to the secret back room where, you know, they make you open up all your bags and take everything out. They're going through my underwear and everything. They start bringing stuff out of my bag. I remember I was reading a book by Chuck Palahniuk at the time. I can't remember which book, not Fight Club. But anyway, they look at the book and they're like, oh, do you like this book? And I'm like, what kind of question is that even? Like, what does that... If I say yes, am I a terrorist? If I say no, am I a terrorist? I don't know how to answer. I'm like, well, it's kind of good, I guess. I thought the first part was better than... I don't know how to answer that. And then they get my diary. I have my journal that I'm keeping. And they get it out of them and they're flipping through it. And they say, can we take a copy of this? And I at that point, I'm like, I don't know. Can you? Like, are you asking me? I don't want to give permission, but I don't know what my rights are here. I have no idea what's going on. What is any of this about? And I think, you know, if there's an arrow through the brain moment where it's like, oh, something is happening here, and this is not just about, you know, scary bearded Muslim boogeymen. I did have a beard at the time, so maybe that was contributory to it, but... No, something's going on here. And at the very least, that might have been one of the seeds that was kind of sitting there waiting to be watered when I started falling down the internet rabbit hole.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's great to share the information, to put it out there. The information is still being transmitted. People are still listening. So as long as people are willing to listen, you know, I think we should...
But you know what? Let me just say, that is both the thing that is the most optimistic and hopeful to me, but simultaneously the most frustrating. Because, yes, I mean, for example, for people who don't know, I was kicked off of YouTube a few years ago. I was permanently suspended from Patreon for daring to talk about what is now perfectly admitted and perfectly documented scientific fact about the scamdemic. There's nothing that I said that wouldn't be perfectly permissible today. But anyway, it was good enough to get me scrubbed from those platforms a few years ago, greatly limiting my reach. But I'm still out there and I'm still doing it. And that's sort of the frustrating part about this, because when I go on somebody else's podcast and they post it to YouTube, and I'll always see someone in the comments go, "Oh, James, I remember that guy. I thought he got banned from the internet." No, I didn't get banned from the internet. I got banned from YouTube. And if you think YouTube is the internet, then you do not understand the revolution, the communication revolution that we're living through, and you are going to be herded back into the information corral, because it's just going to be the same mainstream establishment, six corporations control everything you see in the 20th century. It will devolve into that. It's already devolving into that in the 21st century. It's all Meta, Google, Facebook, whatever. Those are the people that are controlling this conversation increasingly, because we are allowing, we're stepping into it. We're putting our identities into their systems, and then shocked Pikachu face when, oh, they're telling me what I can and can't say. But yeah, the internet is not that. The internet is truly a decentralized communications platform, and there are ways to take advantage of it as such. Some that are complicated. Hey, how do I set up an XMPP server to start, you know, messaging with my friends? You know, people, I get there are a lot of people who that's maybe a step too far. But how about something really simple, like really simple syndication, RSS? You do not have to go to Twitter to get your news. You do not have to allow the Twitter algorithm to tell you what is the trending news stories. No, you can start to collect your own list of sources. I like this website. I like that blog. I like this guy. And create a news feed for yourself that isn't managed by anybody, and nobody can come along and scrub someone from it. It's your list that you control. It's incredibly easy to do, but unfortunately these days most people go, RSS? I think I've heard of it. I don't know what that is. So we have a long way to go in informing people about this, but I'm telling you, yes, there is an incredible revolution that's going on right now. The only question is, are you a part of it, or are you going to get swept along into the next control paradigm?
Yeah, and one of the great things that James does is it's probably about every month, right? You have a solutions watch, so you'll bring up
every
topics
week, hopefully,
like this.
Yeah,
to how to create news, how to interact, and what I always like is we always come back to the real solutions, and the realest solution that we have ever experienced 11 years ago, you know, we went down the 9/11 rabbit hole and we saw a lot of other different things. And for me as a Christian, you know what my red pill moment was, is when I learned American history about Baptist preachers being persecuted in America and beaten and, you know, being required to have permits to preach. And I'm like, wait a minute, like, that not in America, like, that didn't happen in America. I mean, that's why they fled here for, like, religious liberty. And so, like, that was my, like, red pill moment. And I started researching all that, and we were in a densely populated area in the Northeast, and you skyrocketing prices and all this stuff. And we had a couple young children, and we're contemplating our future and how are our children going to be able to afford to live? You know, how are we going to help build a legacy for our children? How are they going to be able to afford property and like the next generation? And we're like, you know what? We're going to move. And Jack Spirko talks about it, walking to freedom, you know, and we decided to move 11 years ago. We saw a lot of these different things, a lot of different things that are written about in the book and in the essays, you know, and because of that, you know what, we're going to control what we can control. We're going to do what we can do. We're going to look at what's available, and we're going to act on that. And so 11 years ago, we moved. We started trying to grow our own food. You know, we got a mess of chickens, and we got a bunch of cows. And you know what? Every day, we do a little something. Every day, we do 1%, whether it's setting up a fence, refining a system, adding infrastructure, you know, and these are all the things that we can control in our realm. We don't have to hope for a political messiah or a political savior. We don't have to hope for somebody to finally keep a promise, or, you know, we don't have to vote harder, but we can do a little something every day. If something positive political ever happens, I'm not saying that it has ever happened, but if it does, I'll take it. I mean, I'll take whatever I can get. But in the meantime, you know what? I'm going to love my neighbor. I'm going to see if I can help them. I'm going to go collect my chicken eggs in the backyard when it's time to process a cow. We're going to do that. And we're going to keep on moving and living. And obviously, we're going to be aware of what's going on. We're going to be aware of this restrictive legislation and the things that are trying to impose on us and the way that they're trying to genetically manipulate food to the point that it doesn't exist anymore as a what we understand as food. And in the same realm, genetically as human beings, as they try to deconstruct us genetically and then merge us with the, you know, the brain chip, and we can be super combatants now for Palantir and Anadrill or whatever Lord of the Rings euphemism that you want to use for all this stuff. But, you know, that's why I love your information, because I just started consuming it and it made us think differently. It moved the Overton window for us. It changed our paradigm. And rather than getting sucked into a right-left paradigm, let's look at what we can do. Let's look at what we can control. Let's look at what we can do on a daily basis, where we can take the liberties that we do have and max them out and try to build a future for our children, and then teach our children, right? It's one thing for us to learn it, but if we don't teach it to the next generation, because they can stand on the shoulders of giants, you know, I'm certainly not a giant by any stretch of the imagination, but if they stand,
but
on
you're
my
standing
shoulders,
on the shoulder of giants, so they are by proxy,
right? They will definitely be able to see farther than me, and that is what is very hopeful to me. And that is our intent. And, you know, that's why I wanted to bring you on to talk about the book. Yeah. I think it's some excellent information.
Can I just say, I appreciate that. That is the most gratifying sort of feedback I could ever receive. Because if people get my work and then take out of it that, oh, it's all, you know, it's all some vast conspiracy and we're all just hopeless and might as well give up and die, that is not my message. My message is, no, the power is yours. It always has been. All you have to do is recognize that and reclaim it. They want you fighting with your neighbor to the death as if, oh, you voted the wrong way in the last election. You have just ruined my life. No. That is not where the power lies. That is not what is really happening in your life. You have the power, and you can work with people in your community to build things in the real world, to create things as we are meant to do as human beings, to be creative individuals and to do things in the world. And to the extent that that message gets across, then my work is done, because ultimately that's what it's about, is people realizing their own power.
Well, James, I appreciate you just putting in an inordinate amount of effort, and you've been undeterred by the technocratic censorship, and, you know, and by you being steadfast and undeterred, it gives, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships, you know, and it does help others to just stay the course. And in closing, is there anything that you want to leave the listeners with?
I think we've covered a lot of bases today. Let me just say, yes, a lot of them are in my book, Reportage, Essays on the New World Order. I hope people will check it out. A lot of essays on these types of topics, from how to really defeat globalism to biotech billionaires and GMO doomsday to that letter to the future that you mentioned. Some of the stuff in there is funny. Some of it is, I hope, thought-provoking, and others hopefully touching and poignant. So I hope people will check out the book.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on, y'all. This is a value for value proposition. So if you do enjoy this information, please go on over to thetexasboys.com. If you are in the Northeast Texas area, we do currently have a half a cow. So send us an email at countrytexasboys@gmail.com. And we will see y'all on the next show.